sun, wondering what went wrong. Falling down on your knees, asking for sympathy, and being caught in between all you wish for and all you've seen. Trying to find anything that you feel that you can believe in.
Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. And I'm Karen Tate, and you were just listening to a little snippet called In the Sun by Laura Kane. Well, this week on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, I'm venturing a bit off our usual topics, but still with fun and informative information for you nonetheless. I think my listeners, quite frankly, are just right for this sort of detective work, and we've learned to be critical thinkers and not just swallow what traditional academia or religion tells us to believe. So along those lines, I think our two guests tonight will be lots of fun for listeners out there. First up, alternative history, things and artifacts found that are clearly out of place according to traditional history, are my topic with Lamont Wood, author of Out of Place in Time and Space. And then in the second part of the show, Philip Copens, editor of Eric von Daniken's new book, Odyssey of the Gods, discusses not just that, but his book, The Ancient Alien Question. He poses the question and gives us some answers. Why are we still asking questions about ETs? And he brings up the Chinese Roswell, and are today's gods just ancient aliens? And the tantalizing ET connection that that ties together archaeological evidence and the 2012 phenomenon. So we're in uncharted territory tonight, a little bit off our usual subject, but I'm looking forward to it. And by the way, as long as we're talking about shows and topics, I want to make sure you didn't miss any of these past shows and guests. Most recently, we had Professor Candace Kant on the show talking about the anthology that was just put out by her publishing company called that is an exaltation of the Egyptian goddess Sekhmet. Then Vicki Garrison, she told us about the dangers of the Quiverful movement and dominionist Christianity, especially for women. Bernardo Kastrup, author of Dreamed Up Reality, and we talked about rational ground for the spiritual and mystical. Vicki Alvier Schechter, we talked about Cleopatra Selene, Cleopatra the Seventh's daughter, and the topic of demonizing powerful women. And finally, Mary McKay, creating the rituals of goddess inspired by Maria Gimbutas. So you can catch any of those shows from the archives. And next week, we have Reverend Billy on the show, and you may know him from the documentary What Would Jesus Buy? Reverend Billy, he's a radio show host himself. He has the Church of Earth Elusia. He talks to us from the Billy Pulpit in the Church of Stop Shopping, just in time for the holidays, which reminds me, by the way, of the new tradition we discussed last week for the upcoming Christmas season. Don't buy your friends stuff they don't need, especially if it's made in China. Support local businesses and give your friends gift certificates or make purchases from local craftspeople and artists. So support the local economy, your neighbors and friends. Then following Reverend Billy next Wednesday, we have Professor Gina Messina Dysart discussing the Feminist and Religion Project and Femme Theologians. So that's what just passed and what's just coming up. And before we get going tonight, I just want to shout out to one of my listeners, Bernice. She sent me a really lovely email. I just wanted to read a little bit of it to you because it's really gas in my tank. She says, Mrs. Tate, I've been listening to as many of your shows as I can squeeze in. She's recently returned to college. She's a women's studies major. And she says, I so appreciate you. I'm taking feminist spirituality this semester and was so excited to listen to Candace Can't Speak About Sekhmet. Vicki Garrison was also so incredibly engaging and interesting. I'm in the midst of 5 really heavy courses, and it feels like all the discourse has been about the damage done to women and our bodies, and I was truly starting to feel ground into pulp and having a real crisis of heart. Then to hear Garrison talk about how her own consciousness expanded and she's been able to recognize the shackles and throw them off, wow, it gave me such a thrill and such hope. So thank you all so much. Once I graduate, I plan on traveling and hope one day to have the funds to attend one of your amazing journeys. Bright blessings and thanks for all you do. Well, thanks, Bernice. I appreciate you and all my listeners, and I'm so glad you enjoyed the last show. Thanks for your feedback. Also, listeners, remember, we are usually on the air here live at 6 p.m. every Wednesday, and that's Pacific time. That's the time you can catch the show live or any other time later from the archives at your convenience. You can also listen via iTunes as well. And if you can't tune in live and have questions, you can always email several days before showtime. And as always, I thank you for your input and your feedback. So stay tuned and call in if you like. The number is 718-766-4662. My first guest, Lamont Wood, is happy to take your questions. And I'm going to save most of the announcements for the bottom of the show so as not to keep Lamont waiting any longer. So let me start with a little bit of an intro to Mr. Wood. He's a journalist and a freelance writer of wide experience. He's familiar with the sometimes arbitrary distinction between cause and effect and the subsequent gulf between what happens, what's experienced, what actually gets written, and what is understood. Lamont has been freelancing for nearly 3 decades. He writes for publications ranging from American Heritage to trade journals in Hong Kong. He's also been a newspaper reporter, a publicist, and a welder. He lives in San Antonio, Texas today. So, Lamont, you are a guy who wears lots of hats.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. The book, again, is called Out of Place in Time and Space. And basically, it's a collection of historical anecdotes that seem to fly in the face of a linear conception of time, basically, or even causality, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
A collection of things that, well, I came up with I started collecting these things over the years, making first mental notes and then written notes, I guess, and then fleshed out the notes, and then suddenly we have this book here.
So suddenly your collection came so big, you realized you had quite the collection that warranted a book. Well,
yeah.
Well, Lamont, as you're going, I'm wondering, as you were reading about these things, did you run across situations where, for instance, I know when I was researching my own book, I stumbled across a female archaeologist who discovered something in Mexico or South America, I can't remember which, but the artifact didn't fit the accepted history and timeline. And she basically got blackballed from archaeology because I guess too many people's careers were invested in the accepted timeline, and there was just no room sometimes for established academia to open their mind to things like this.
Yeah.
Did you encounter any of that?
The examples I have are all fairly well documented, let's put it that way. And although some are kind of gray, and probably people are still fighting over some of them, frankly. And some of the reviews of my book, in fact, took offense at some of the things I said. But at least, you know, they bought it and read it. Hey, so yes, I've encountered some of that.
I think
the example you're talking about would be the Roman head that they found in the Aztec city. The ruins dated to 1520, and the heads in the Vespasian era in 200 AD or something like that.
Honestly, the part I remembered about it, which unnerved me, was the fact, number one, that, you know, I was naively under the impression that, history, that knowledge and history was something that teachers, you know, people in academia would cherish. You know, I didn't realize ego entered into the picture so much. And again, call me naive, but I figured
and bureaucracy too sometimes.
But that too, and so I'm figuring, you know, if something, you know, if something's uncovered that warrants a look and a rethinking of history, I'm thinking, well, of course. Scientists and teachers and professors and scholars. Well, of course they're going to give a second look, but apparently they're always, you know, they're not always so willing to do that. I don't think.
Yeah. Well, in my book we have the example of the Kennewick Man, which was actually caught up in court for several years. I mean, and this is a fairly recent thing. I mean, we're not talking, you know, 150 years ago, and people, you know, throwing various misconceptions at each other. Various superstitions, you know. This is, I think, the bones were found in '96, I think, in on the side of a river in Kennewick, Washington. And I don't know if you're familiar with that story, but that's the one where it was a human skeleton, and there was an arrowhead buried in the thigh. And well, it was a forgotten pioneer, because it had Caucasian features. But then someone looked at the arrowhead and realized, you know, that thing's thousands of years old. So they did carbon dating and stuff like that, and realized the skeleton was 9,300 years old. Now, to be 9,300 years old and have Caucasian features and be in Kennewick, Washington, that's kind of like mutually exclusive.
Right.
Yeah. And
yeah,
if he actually came from Europe,
fine.
He had a long walk, you know. And so, and as for any explanation, no. Still don't have one. The lawsuit was about because various Native Indian tribes claimed the remains under the Federal Indian Remains Repatriation Act, which was passed because various Indian tribes got tired of their ancestors' remains being used as curios, basically. And so when such remains are found, they can claim them. And they tried to do that, and it went back and forth. And finally, the court decided that really there was no tribe had a really good claim to these remains, partly because they're apparently not Indian. So scientists were actually able thereupon to get at the bones. And then it got even more interesting because they said, well, it may be Caucasian or maybe, you know, what you call Caucasoid. It's not really Caucasian, but it has some Caucasian-like features, which would make it, rather than someone from Europe, maybe someone who belongs to the Ainu tribe in northern Japan. But you see, that's about as far away as Europe is. I mean, that's not unproven.
Yeah, just in the other direction.
Yeah, it's in the other direction. So, but the other thing you got to remember, you know, this is from 9,000 years ago, and the DNA map may have been different then. I mean, we don't really have that much evidence from 9,000 years ago. They've only found a few other skulls that are that old in North America. One of them was African, and the other one they found was Polynesian. So, which would that's also hard to explain.
Right,
I mean,
right.
On the current DNA map, those people were really out of place too. But you know, maybe things were different then. You know.
I find the premise of your book really interesting. You know, actually, you know, bringing to the foreground things in history that shouldn't be there, at least shouldn't be there the way we think we understand history. And so you say in your book that one of the examples is a painting made in 1460 showing a flying toy helicopter.
Yeah, full-string flying toy helicopter. Yeah. Let me give you a little background though. When I collected all these anecdotes, I was looking for a high concept that would tie them all together, and I came up with what I call the reverse anachronism. Now, standard anachronism is when you go to the movies, and the movie's about Rome, and the actors are speaking English. Well, that's an anachronism. They're being portrayed as doing something that they wouldn't have done in Rome, but
right.
You expect that because you don't know Latin. Now, to me, so I define reverse anachronism, that's when you look into the past and see something there that appears to be from the present. An example of that would be this full-string flying toy helicopter. It is a painting that's been hanging at a museum in France. It's a fairly conventional church setting with the Christ child sitting in the lap of the Madonna. And probably for centuries, no one paid much attention to what the Christ child is depicted as doing, except in the last few decades, we look at it and realize, oh, he's playing a pull-string flying toy helicopter, we look at it, and that's obviously what it is, because we have helicopters nowadays. We know what those things are. But the painting was made in 1460, which is kind of weird. Apparently, the artist put it in there on the assumption that the public at that time would know what it was. He put it in the, presumably in the hands of the Christ child to show that this is, in fact, a child, because artistic conventions and children were the scale model adults. And also, it allowed him to introduce a crucifix motif, you know, the helicopter has four blades. This also implies, though, that, you know, these things were in common use in 1460, and the public would have known what it was, not you know, be puzzled by this. Yet, you know, in engineering history and aeronautical history, the first serious attempt at rotary wing flying machine, and they date to like 1784, 400 years after this, the first successful man carrying one in 1806, et cetera. And no one mentions any toys from the Middle Ages, you know, in these histories. But apparently, they were in common use by children during the Middle Ages. The children down the street were playing with, in the Middle Ages, were playing with small flying machines, which is mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, it is. It is pretty mind-boggling. I mean, in your research, I mean, could you find any explanation for it? I mean, did Da Vinci live down the street or something?
Da Vinci was 8 years old when this was made. Pulling things together, I assume that this is a powered whirligig. You know, a whirligig is the thing that rotates. You have it on a stick, you know, and you wave it in the air, and the thing turns and makes noises and colors flash. You know, it's a little weather vane you use as a toy, basically, spinning weather vane. Of course, if you take it off the stick and you spin the thing directly, you can make it fly if you do it right. That'd be even more entertaining. Someone discovered that and they turned it into a toy. Now, doing research on other topics in the book, I ran across this theme, and that apparently children's toys are too frivolous for serious attention, but they can embody high technology. We have this example. We've all heard of the wheeled toys they find in Central American tombs from cultures that did not themselves use wheeled transportation. That was presumably because they didn't have draft animals and decent roads, so it wouldn't have, you know, done them any good. I also came across the fact that the Romans and Greeks had steam-powered toys, although apparently never occurred to them to use these things to do serious work. They could have, you know, put a belt on it, run it to a pump, and actually done something, but you never hear of that happening.
Well, wait a minute. You're going a little bit faster than my brain is comprehending.
Okay.
Before you got to the Roman and Greek steam powered toys, you right. just said that there were some other toys in Mesoamerica or something.
Right.
What were those toys now?
The wheeled toys. Toys with
wheeled toys. But
yeah,
we didn't have the wheel yet. We weren't using the wheel as a tool at that point.
Not in those cultures, no. They're not known to have wheeled transports. They didn't have carts and wagons. And
interesting.
Stuff like that.
Interesting. Okay. So then you end up with the steam powered toys, in Greek and Rome, in Greece and Rome. Well, speaking of Rome, in your book you talk about an ancient manuscript that talks about a battle where a Roman army is defeated by huge machines. What was that?
Actually, three different manuscripts mention it. Three different ancient historians talking about the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage in about 200 BC or so. And during this war, the city-state of Syracuse, which is on the coast of Sicily, had been a Roman satellite, but there was a coup d'etat or something that defected to the Carthaginian side. And Rome sent an army to retake the place. This is while Hannibal was running wild in Italy and stuff, with elephants and stuff. And so far, so good. And the army got there. And the thing is, the military defense planning for the city-state of Syracuse had been put in the hands of a guy named Archimedes, whom you may have heard of. This is the guy famous for inventing the mechanical screw and coming up with the mathematical description of how levers work,
mm-hmm.
and similar things. Okay. They approach the city. The Romans attacked during daylight, and as they got to the city wall, they found themselves being hit by missile fire, indirect. It came over the wall and down on them, and it tracked them as they moved, even up to the foot of the wall, which I thought was possible because usually those things are at minimum range. Now that that implies very carefully tuned catapults, which is, you know, torsional artillery they used, accurate range finders, and centralized fire control. Now, that kind of thing you don't see in modern armies until about 1900, the combination of centralized fire control and range finders and all this stuff, which is really weird. They so anyway, that drove them off. They returned at night with a naval attack the city wall. The defense wall was right on the coast, and they could bring ships right up to it. And they brought their ships up, and they had scaling ladders, and they were going to scale the wall directly from the ships. And as they did so, these large machines reared up from the other side of the wall and swung booms out over the water, from which they either dropped large rocks onto the ships or actually dropped grappling hooks, which would, like, snag them at one end and pull them up, and the other side would go down, and they would capsize them. And, of course, they panicked and ran away and eventually recovered and laid siege to the city and captured it that way. But the accounts of these things, like I say, read like something out of science fiction, yet they show up in the pages of three different ancient historians, people who are writing it from first-person accounts during the ancient period.
So would you say, well, can you draw the conclusion? I mean, we're going to talk about other examples, but my brain's taken away here as you're talking about these different examples. And could, people from our past have been better educated and more talented than maybe we gave them credit for?
Well, I think that's very common, especially when you talk about someone like Archimedes. Apparently, he invented something that what we would look at and think of as construction cranes, where you have the upright pillar and then horizontal crossboom. He must have come up with something that looked pretty much like that, and probably powered by pre-positioned drop weights. But he, like I say, he managed to. They must have been laying flat before the attack. The Romans didn't know about them, and he was able to swing them up and mount them up, then swing the booms out and manipulate them and actually, like I say, grapple the enemy ships. All that, like I say, would have taken some power source, which I assume was like some Rube Goldberg-like pre-positioned drop weight thing.
Right, right.
But they would look very modern to us, is what I'm saying.
Right, right, exactly. They would look out of place for the time period, and
right.
One wonders why, you know, maybe we haven't uncovered the schematics for stuff like this, you know, then we wouldn't be so surprised that these things existed.
Well, I'm quite sure it was kept a military secret at the time. Archimedes himself left a pretty broad body of work all about covering fairly pure research, nothing specific, no actual diagrams of actual machines. It was all theoretical stuff. But you see, the actual practical stuff would have been kept secret. But some of the theoretical stuff is, for instance, about like how to determine the volume of a curved shape. Okay, well, a ship's hull is a curved shape. And once you know its volume, you know how much it weighs, and therefore you know how much effort it would take to capsize one.
Right.
So it all comes together when you look at it.
Right. Well, you cite other examples of these reverse anachronisms, people writing about the moons of Mars 150 years before they were discovered.
Yeah. That's a really bizarre one. Yes, the moons of Mars were actually described about 150 years before they were discovered. They are mentioned in the book Gulliver's Travels, who you might have encountered in school. And it was written in 1726. And in it, he mentions the astronomers of one of the fictional countries that Gulliver encounters. And apparently the writer is trying to show that the scientists of this country are superior to European ones. And he mentions that they have better telescopes and they have found these X, Y, and Z things. And this includes two moons of Mars that were unknown in Europe. And he actually mentions how far away they are from Mars in terms of planetary diameters and what their orbital period is in terms of hours. And it implies they're not very big and not very far from Mars, basically. And 150 years later, they did find two moons of Mars, and they are not very big and not very far from Mars. However, the description that shows up in Gulliver's Travels don't really match the real moons of Mars, Deimos and Phobos. But you still have to wonder how did he get even vaguely accurate as he was?
Right. Well, you know what that reminds me of, and I don't know whether you ran across this, but my brain is only capturing part of it, but maybe you'll know what I'm talking about. The Dogon tribe.
Yeah, the Dogon tribe. Yeah, yeah.
They were an example of an ancient people or a primitive people that knew about moons or stars. I forget which it was didn't even discover till we had. The powerful enough telescopes rather recently in our history.
Right, yeah. They're talking about the star Sirius, which is the brightest star in the northern sky. And a French anthropologist interviewing a local a holy man in, I guess, what it was, the late 40s, 50s, something like that, encountered a number of things from this guy, including his reference to Sirius having a satellite, a companion star, which was discovered by European astronomers, actually American astronomers, in 1852, I think. And at that time, it required like the biggest available telescope to discover it. So a lot of people drew inferences that the Dogon in Mali and in West Sahara Africa knew about this. But I have to point out that by the time this interview took place, France had been running that part of Africa since 1890 and had been recruiting people from the French army and some of these people became officers, went to college, all that stuff. So there's been a lot of cross-cultural contamination. The man on the street in Mali could easily know about Sirius A and B if he read anything about astronomy.
So what you're saying is you're not sure that the Dogon people knew about it before Western society knew about
it. Yeah, because you need a really impressive telescope to discover Sirius B. Its distance from Sirius A in terms of apparent separation is like smaller than the diameter of the disk of the planet Jupiter as seen from Earth. And you can't tell without a telescope that Jupiter is even a disk. It's just a bright dot. So the distance between A and B is small. It would fit inside that bright dot that you see with the naked eye. Plus, one of those, Sirius A, is hundreds of times brighter than Sirius B. So basically, you need a fairly nice telescope to differentiate them. They didn't have them. Some people said, well, they maybe got from the ancient Egyptians who must have had telescopes. So there's no other evidence the Egyptians had telescopes. They would doubtless use them for other things. The resulting astronomical information would have shown up in their worldview, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not there.
I think where some people go, some people's minds go, which sort of ties into the second half of the show, is, for things that are sort of unexplainable or we think might be unexplainable like this, we wonder if there were some, ETs, for lack of a better word. I mean, I know it's so cliche now, but, ETs that maybe informed these ancient people and I don't know. It does make one wonder.
It does. But throughout the book, I stick to, Occam's razor, that the explanation that requires a few assumptions and one to go with. And
yeah.
So I typically go with that, but I'm the first to admit that that doesn't always lead to the correct answer. You know,
right.
You can run into walls of that or just, you know, go in circles, et cetera.
Well, and I'm thinking about other things that I've run across, too. I mean, I stood in the Abydos Temple in Egypt and looked up at the relief, a relief near the ceiling, very awkward to get to, very high up, and it appeared to have carved on it a helicopter and a tank.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, I've never really taken the time to research that, but that sort of sounds like that might fit into your reverse anachronism.
Yeah, and I don't know which ones you're talking about, and the explanations I have seen, which satisfy me, is that what you're looking at is the results of they made the inscription. Someone made a mistake. They plastered over the mistake. Part of the plaster has since fallen off, and it looks kind of weird, basically. And part of it looks like a little diagram of a schematic side view of maybe Apache gunship. I remember that one. I remember, and there's that other one that may look like a tank, like you're talking about. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the original sign was supposed to be an Apache gunship or a tank. It's just nowadays the damage reminds us of that.
So you're saying that it's been distorted, and it didn't originally look like that. It's been distorted over time, and now that's what our modern eye sees when we look at it.
Yeah. But beyond that, I do have several sections devoted to medieval and Renaissance church art, and which various paintings which appear to depict UFOs out in the sky, flying saucers, something like that.
Right.
And some of them look pretty darn convincing.
Really? Yeah.
But again, I have to point out, I can't. If you really believe it, go ahead. You know, I can't. You can't prove a negative. It's the beauty of all this. But when we look at these things and say, gosh, there's a flying saucer in the air, what we're doing is we're taking our visual vocabulary and imposing it on people who had their own. In fact, they have pretty broad, rich visual vocabulary, most of which is now lost on us. If you look through some of these paintings, it's filled with imagery, much of which is a mystery nowadays.
So you're saying we just can't identify what they were painting, and we've sort of jump to the conclusion, more or less, that it's a flying saucer.
Yeah. Now, there are reference books out there of iconography, et cetera. And if you were looking at that, usually, obviously, you know, these are depictions of Bible stories. I mean, they were paid for by church officials. The artist wanted to get paid. Everything in there was as assigned and backs up the Bible story. And so if you see over the, as in one of the paintings, over the Virgin's shoulder, you can look out into the night sky and you see this oblong shape out there. Yeah, it looks like a flying saucer, but then you notice people on the ground reacting to it. And around the people on the ground are sheep. Well, of course, that means these are the shepherds in the Nativity story who are tending their flocks by night and are confronted with the heavenly host. Now, how do you depict the heavenly host, you know, as a Renaissance artist? Well, they seem to depict it as or the divine presence, as a sort of rent in the sky, a hole in the sky, because they were schooled in Aristotelian astronomy, where the fixed stars are actually stuck on the inside of a crystal sphere that surrounds the solar system. And for God to get at us, apparently, you have to make a hole in that sky, and angels come through it. Apparently, that's what's happening in so many
things. That's a black hole.
basically, their version of it. And to us, it looks like, you know, a flying saucer in the air. Now, in some of these cases...
So this was lousy artists, basically, that, you know, taking creative license to draw something that no one's ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really... The Bible doesn't really say what it looked like, so they had to come up with something. And in some of these paintings, also, if you paid a museum $150 for the high-res version, like I had to do, you see in some of them, the hole is actually like a circle of angels. You can see their faces and halos and wings and stuff. But,
well, Matt, you're bursting my bubble here.
I'm sorry. But, you know.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I want to hear what you have to say. I don't want to go through life deluded.
Okay. But it is a big topic, you know, Renaissance art. And these were heavily richly done illustrations of Bible stories intended for, I assume, illiterate audiences. So they crammed a lot in there, frankly. So you can just study the heck out of them, basically.
So would I be going too far to say you don't believe any of the old paintings that supposed to have flying saucers in them were really flying saucers? You don't think people were seeing flying saucers back then and just painting what they saw?
None of the examples I have come across convince me of that yet.
Okay.
Doesn't mean it hasn't happened, does it? I mean,
yeah.
You can go on believe, but the example I have come across, there's always an explanation.
So in your book, have you found an explanation for every one of the reverse anachronisms?
By no means, no. There's some that are complete mysteries.
Okay.
Now, a few of them are basically like engineers thinking in parallel centuries apart. For instance, one example would be Admiral Nelson and his memo for the fighting of the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805. And it's based on a mathematical breakdown of what he expected the layout of the enemy fleet would be when they got there. And he assigned so many ships to attack so many at certain points in the enemy line. And we had no idea why he was doing that until 1916, 111 years later, when someone in Lanchester, of course, invented these so-called Lanchester equations, or the N-squared law of mutual attrition. And when you use that to analyze his battle plan, you realize he was using that formula, except the formula was published 111 years later.
Well, could he have just stumbled onto that something that worked, and he didn't
He must have stumbled on something similar that worked and presumably kept it secret for military purposes.
Hmm.
It is, you know, raises the hair on the back of your head. Again, the reverse anachronism. At the time, no one understood what he was talking about, so if they did go out and obey him, they won the battle overwhelmingly. Nowadays, we have the information to look at and see what he's talking about.
Right.
But there are other things that, I don't have any explanation for, and probably the best one would be the one from Jules Verne's first novel, which he wrote in 1865. Of course, he's now famous as a science fiction author. He wrote actually more than 50 books, novels, most of which were not science fiction. He was more into adventure novels, really. But his first book, called From Earth to Moon, in English, depicts an American effort to send three men to the moon and an aluminum capsule, which is launched from Florida. They circle the moon, they return to Earth, they land in the Pacific Ocean, and are picked up by the U.S. Navy. Now, does that sound familiar?
Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it gets weirder, like the plot mentions Texas politicians making trouble because they wanted to be involved in this. And in the actual space program, that did happen, and that is why Mission Control is located in Houston.
Huh.
Now, beyond that, his novel includes a fairly detailed budget for the program. And modern analysis, taking inflation into account, shows that his budget was about 85% of the actual cost of the Apollo project at the time of the Apollo 8 mission, which is apparently he's depicting here. So it just gets freakier and freakier. And I say, well, he must have not have included that managerial overhead, as many amateurs do.
So, wow.
But where did he get all this, you know?
Well, it does make you wonder. I mean, because people like him, and then, you know, you have, like, Da Vinci. I mean, all of his drawings, and some of them looked so futuristic.
Right.
You know, I mean, were these people, were they just so amazingly creative, or were they tapped into something that that we can't imagine?
Well, maybe a little of both. I think Da Vinci is more of an example of again, engineers thinking on parallel lines centuries apart. He's just maybe the first one to get to the table with some of these ideas. But with Vernon, I can't figure this out. And in terms of an engineer approaching it, it actually doesn't really apply. I mean, he depicts the American Space Program as being involving a cannon. They're actually shooting people out of a cannon, which wouldn't have worked. It would kill you, you know.
Right.
But that wouldn't using a rocket would not have been acceptable to readers at the time. Rockets then being black powder things are weak and prone to exploding. And they did understand, artillery. And so he could describe all that and it would be, you know, believable at that level. So wait,
I'm getting confused between the aluminum space capsule and the cannon. Are you saying that, was that two separate things he wrote about?
No, in his book they fired the aluminum capsule as an artillery shell in his case.
Oh, so they fired it out of a cannon.
Right, with three men in it. Which wouldn't work in reality, but anyway.
Oh, I see. Okay, rather than, you know, the kind of liftoff thing that we're used to seeing, you know, in Florida, he was saying it was going to be projected into the atmosphere from a cannon.
They're going to build a huge cannon sunk, most of the barrel sunk into the ground.
Still, the whole idea that they, you know, that there was even, you know, people going to space, and like you said, I mean, he got so many things right, even if he didn't get the canon part of it right.
But his case is not really that of an engineer's thinking along parallel lines centuries apart. With him, maybe he was tapped into something, like you're saying. I don't know. I have no explanation for this. I'm a little worried that he doesn't talk about later visits to the moon, and now that we're ramping down the whole thing, I'm a little worried about this. Maybe because I would like
I might blow your mind in this, Lamont, but I'll just say it anyway. I remember hearing somebody recently talk about how, you know, some of our greatest minds, like I think Steve Jobs, you know, admitted to taking hallucinogens because, you know, they expand the mind and, you know, how we think and creativity. You know, you wonder if maybe, you know, in ancient Greece and Rome, you know, things like that were commonplace. You know, you wonder if maybe, of course you can't answer this, I mean, it's a rhetorical question, but, you know, you just wonder if maybe hallucinogens sort of expanded these people's minds, I guess, you know.
Well, we don't know. That's a good point, though. We know in Egypt that they worship a certain lotus plant that presumably, if it's related to the ones we know about, may have been had some hallucinogenic properties. But as far as the others, who knows, you know.
Yeah. Well, now your book also talks about people making predictions about the future. You want to get into that part a little bit?
Well, I kept running across people who base their careers on visions of the future, basically. Correct ones. They turned out to be correct. And the odd thing about that is that you would expect anyone who did that to be, well, to have a wildly successful career, basically, if they're actually seeing the future. And but the people I've run across actually did that. No, they didn't. They weren't. It didn't make them wildly successful or even happy, for that matter. There's the guy.
Well, did they have a pattern of being able to predict things, or was it just like, you know, they predicted one thing in their life that actually, you know, came to fruition?
It was more like one thing, yes.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the examples?
Well, there's the guy who wrote the book about the Pacific War and World War II, the Pacific Campaign, except he wrote it in 1926, and the war didn't start until, 1941 or whatever. And he talks about the beginning of a Japanese surprise attack and how the Japanese overrun the Western Pacific and then eventually succumbed to a methodical island-hopping campaign by the U.S. Mm-hmm. Navy and sue for peace after the U.S. starts launching bombing raids on their cities. Now, does that sound familiar?
It sure does. That's pretty amazing. That's really specific.
Yeah, and he describes these he makes up, you know, battles, and he mentioned ships by names in these battles, And weirdly, some of them do show up in the war, which is freaky when you read it. But that is
you mean the battle, the names of the battleships he
had
down?
The names of the ships themselves. And, of course, that is because some of those ships are still around, or because they recycled ship names, frankly.
So you're saying the ship names may have been the names of ships in his time period.
Yeah. So
okay.
He mentions people, but that's all fictional, and none of them come about. He's not that good. The Japanese surprise attack that opens it, he has them attacking the Panama Canal rather than Hawaii, which made even more sense, frankly. And the battles he mentioned, they're not quite perfect reflections of what actually did happen, but most of them do have some counterparts. He has, for instance, a culminating battle off Yap Island. Well, that's a little to the west of Battle of the Philippine Sea, which was where it did culminate, et cetera, et cetera. Now, again, you're asking, did these people profit from their prophecy? In this case, when war did actually break out, he went to his hotel room in London and drank himself to death. So apparently not. Maybe he saw too much or something. But this guy, his name was Hector Bywater, he was an expert in naval affairs, and he wrote the book basically to show that if war did break out, it would be painful to both sides. And he certainly got that right. But there are so many parallels in it to what actually happened. It's scary. And the big question is, when people read it, or historians look at it, they ask, did that guy, Irosuke Yamamoto, read it? The guy who was head of the Japanese Navy.
And maybe that could have inspired him.
Yes, and the answer is absolutely he did read it. And he lectured about it at various Japanese naval academies and made a point of meeting the author at a convention one time.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, then you also talk about the person who predicted the disaster of the Titanic.
Talk about not profiting from your prophecy. Yes, W.T. Stead. I was a Victorian journalist who was in on the founding of the tabloid genre. Now, with the recent closing of the News of the World and so on, we may be seeing the end of that genre. But it involved a lot of sensationalism, which was which he was up for, apparently. And one of the causes he pursued was his annoyance at the Admiralty in England for not requiring liners to carry enough lifeboats for all the passengers. And he wrote some evocative fiction about what would happen if there was a mid-ocean collision and the panic that would break out, et cetera, the massive loss of life. And another case wrote about what would happen if a liner did hit an iceberg in the middle of the ocean. Two separate stories, in fact, about that. And throughout as a result of his career and tabloid journalism and all that, he managed to found his own magazine at one point and do fairly well, got rich. And at one point, he decided to attend a conference in the U.S., and having gotten rich, he secured the best available ticket for the crossing, which was a first-class cabin on the Titanic. And you have to wonder what he was thinking. Did he count the lifeboats or something? We don't know because he went down with the Titanic.
Right.
So the irony of it is just astonishing, total whatever. It's just this mind-boggling, really. Excuse me.
Wow. Well, now you say that there are other things in your book that couldn't be explained. Can you name some that maybe you haven't shared with us already?
There's a lot of it.
I know how it is. You know, when it takes so long between the time you research the book and the book actually gets on the shelf, so much time's gone by, your memory goes a little, it fades a little bit.
Yeah, my favorite inexplicable example would be the Voynich manuscript, which was discovered by a rare book dealer, I think, named Voynich, of course, in about 1912. It's been dated to 1420. It's a hand-lettered and hand-illustrated book of about 200 pages. 1420, of course, is before the printing press was invented, so, of course, it was hand-illustrated and hand-lettered. The lettering is done by someone who obviously wrote with skill, as if he was used to that language. It's an alphabetical language that follows rules that we can identify, and the text can be analyzed mathematically and falls into patterns that shows that it is a language and not a random word salad. Okay, the problem is that the alphabet appears nowhere else on Earth, and that the rules of this language don't follow the rules of any known language, which is pretty weird. Now, then we get to the illustrations, which appear to be about something, to actually look at them and realize they're not really about anything. There's like illustrations of botanical information, plants and stuff, that match no known plants. There are illustrations that appear to be astronomical information that match nothing from astronomy, or maybe huge doodles, for all we know. So we have no basis for understanding this. We can't prove that it actually contains any information, yet it is written like it does. For instance, if these things are actually words, we can identify words in some part of the manuscript that don't appear to be in others, and presumably are part of the vocabulary of the subject of that chapter, but we can't figure out what even the subject is. Some of the brightest lights in the field of cryptography have tried to decrypt it and come up with nothing convincing. It's been argued that you could get a similar effect by taking gibberish and then encrypting it. And the act of encrypting it would give you those mathematical patterns that we see. But then when you do decrypt it, you end up with the, you know, the original word salad, and there's nothing there. And I say, yeah, if someone wanted to impress the CIA, you might do that, but I don't think there was an issue in 1420.
Right.
So looking again for a rational explanation, the possibility exists that it's what they call an OCD artifact, someone with obsessive-compulsive disorder sat down and did this. People with OCD have been known to invent their own languages and write books in them. That implies that such a sufferer would have had in 1420 access to time and skills and material necessary, which seems to be asking a lot, but it would only take one person, you know, for this to happen. The other possibility is that this is another reverse anachronism. I argue, you know, we were talking about reverse anachronisms earlier, that this is a that it's something from the past that something in the present that seems to show up in the past. Now, if such things exist, and I keep finding examples of them, logic would demand that there are things from the future that are here in the present, and we don't recognize them for what they are because we have nothing in common with them. And so that's just noise, or we mistake them for something else. Maybe that's what this is an example of that. So that's just noise. We can't figure it out. We have nothing in common with it.
Right.
Maybe
in
a few centuries we'll figure it out.
Yeah, we can connect the dots then.
Yeah. So, but you know, we can't do it now.
Well, Lamont, we're starting to run out of time here. I did want to ask you. I know when we first discussed you coming on the show, I'd mentioned to you that when I was researching my book of sacred places, I ran across a Smithsonian article about Egyptian artifacts that were found in a cave in the Grand Canyon, and you sort of teased me a little bit, and I think you sort of said that might be in your sequel. Have you actually been researching that? I'm wondering if you've made any progress on it.
I have started, actually, the sequel. I have not researched a particular event you're talking about. I have run across the fairly well-established discovery of a Roman artifact in Aztec ruins in Mexico.
Okay.
A city that the Aztecs were known to have sacked in 1520 and was deserted at that time. And they found a terracotta thing, a head, that they can pretty reliably date to Rome in about 200 A.D.
Well, then that's not, you know, Grand Canyon and Mexico. I mean, that's not that far away from one another.
Right, right. You know, you expect a little bleed over from one hemisphere to the other from time to time. And the thing about that, people seem to assume that any encounter between Europe and North America would lead to the conquest like the Spanish did in 1500 or whatever, the immediate land rush of, you know, armies and stuff. The issue is, why did the Spanish and Portuguese act that way? That is what is different. I think throughout history, most people would act like the Vikings did in 1000 when they did have that settlement in North America for a little while. It was a place like any other place, long way from home, big deal, let's go back. You know, there was no real draw.
Right,
now,
right.
Now, the Spanish Empire, they had just got through reconquering the Iberian Peninsula from the Muslim armies, and they had this, you know, large army that they didn't really want to demobilize. They had all these men who had been warriors all their lives, and now they were facing unemployment. Well, guess what? Now they had a new outlet. That is what was different about that period. They actually had this impetus they could direct across the ocean.
I see. Okay.
And it was something similar, I think, to the Apollo program. We had a huge military, you know, machine going on. We could direct some of that into the space program.
Okay.
And now we don't have that anymore, so we don't seem to be doing much of that anymore. No, it's
sense. Well, Lamont, I think we might have a caller for you. Let me just check and see if this is just a listener or someone who might want to ask you a question. Hi, caller from the 818 area code. Did you have a question for Lamont?
I think I'm actually your next guest.
Oh, okay. Philip?
Absolutely.
Okay, Philip, we're about ready to wrap it up here, so thank you very much for calling in. Just hang on, and I'll be back with you in just a couple minutes, okay?
Okie dokie.
Thanks.
Okay, well, anyway.
Just real quickly, Lamont, the last thing we were going to cover was you were talking that there were two unexplained things about the New World that might be unsettling if they were explained. One's the origin of maize or corn. Is there a short explanation for that? Because I felt like you dangled that like a carrot, and I wanted to know what you were talking about.
No, there is no explanation for maize. I mean, like corn, you know, corn on the cob.
Uh-huh.
Without human intervention, corn couldn't reproduce. The cob would fall to the ground, all those little things would sprout, and they would strangle each other. So any other plant, though, you know, wheat, rice, stuff, we can trace it to a wild variety. We know where it came from. There is no wild variety of corn like that, and there couldn't be. Like I say, it could not reproduce. There's no seed scattering mechanism. So it must come from somewhere else. We don't know.
Oh, I see. So you're saying we don't really know where it came from.
No, no.
We don't know which. In other words, even what part of the world it came from. It just sprung up.
Yeah, presumably from Central Mexico, and presumably humans bred it from something earlier, which is, and we don't have that anymore. But just beyond that, you know, it's all. We don't know.
Okay, I see.
Botanical monstrosity, really.
I see. Okay. Well, Lamont, it has been interesting, really interesting. So if you want to just tell listeners one more time the name of the book and the website.
It's called Out of Place in Time and Space, and yes, it does rhyme, by Lamont Wood, LamontWood. And I don't have a website. Just go to Amazon, look up Out of Place in Time and Space, or Lamont Wood, LamontWood. or it's in better bookstores. Barnes & Noble has it, and I think Walmart was carrying it in their book section.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Lamont, it has been fun. I thank you so much for all the tantalizing things that you have definitely made us think about tonight.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you, and have a good holiday.
Okay. Same to you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we normally discuss the divine feminine and feminine consciousness and the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. But tonight, we have shifted gears a bit, and we are talking about things we usually don't talk about, alternative history, artifacts that are clearly out of place according to traditional thought and study. And as I promised, our second guest is Phil Copens. He's the editor of Eric Von Daniken's new book, Odyssey of the Gods, and we're going to discuss that a bit, but also his book, The Ancient Alien Question. So let me just tell you a little bit about Philip, and then we'll start our chat. He is an author and investigative journalist, ranging from the world of politics to ancient history and mystery. He co-hosts the Spirit Revolution radio show with his partner Kathleen McGowan, and is a frequent contributor to Nexus magazine and Atlantis Rising magazine. Since 1995, he's lectured extensively and has appeared in a number of television and DVD documentaries, including Ancient Aliens, the series. He's the author of The Stone Puzzle of Rosalind Chapel, The Canopus Revelation, Land of the Gods, The New Pyramid Age, and Servants of the Grail, and the e-book 2012, Science or Fiction. He was born in Belgium. He now lives in the U.S. and the U.K., and his website is philipcopens.com, philipcopens. So, Philip, thank you for being with us tonight. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be on with you, Karen.
Well, you know, we have a lot of ground to cover here, Philip. Originally, you know, we were just going to talk about Von Daniken's new book, but then I realized you had your own out too. So, and in a way, the subjects sort of parallel each other or overlap. Is that correct?
They do, in the sense that both of them address obviously the question whether or not we have been alone in the past, or whether we have been visited, contacted, lived together with another intelligence on this planet. And Eric focuses specifically on ancient Greece. His book is called Odyssey of the Gods. And really what he hopes to achieve with the book is that people look at Greece, ancient Greece specifically, in a different light. We all think that ancient Greece is a civilization which we know, which we, you know, have grown up with. We think we know things like the Odyssey and the Iliad and all of those things. And what he hopes to do in Odyssey of the Gods is really to tell you that we know very little, and that basically that our understanding of ancient Greece, as these people wrote what we think of as fiction or maybe even ancient science fiction, really isn't anything of the kind. What they were leaving behind was a legacy of knowledge, a body of knowledge about ancestors and about deities and about creatures who lived on their territories, of which they had a memory of. And they felt that this was important, that they left a testimony of their accounts to their descendants. The Ancient Alien Question, my book, is very much more geared towards giving people a general overview of where we stand. Were we or were we not alone in the past? And so what I do is very much go into archaeological, historical, anthropological information and basically sketch where we are. Is there evidence that we have been contacted by ET in the past? And has this contact been physical, as in have they been physically present here? Or is it more metaphysical? Have we been somehow contacted on a more brainwave connection, so to speak, rather than just a physical spacecrafty kind of ET kind of encounter? And
okay.
the end conclusion of that book is pretty much that unless you put the burden of proof extraordinarily high, what we have is a very strong indication that yes, we have indeed been contacted, and that the path of civilization which we have walked as mankind definitely hasn't been one which we walked ourselves or by ourselves, and that we have had some help achieving where we have come so far by non-human intelligences.
Well, all right. Well, obviously we have a lot to cover, and I have about an hour. If you can allocate that much time to the show, let's start with Odyssey of the Gods. I mean, Eric's books have been out for a long time. I remember seeing on TV how they were an immediate hit around the world, but of course, you know, scientists sort of scoffed at him. As time has gone on, I would imagine that attitude has changed. Yes?
No, because once you, you know, scientists will scoff at anything as soon as they have scoffed at it. So this is like a permanent marker. It's like the mark of Cain. And this is not something which is typical of Eric. This is, you know, typical of anything. Obviously, also, Eric was trying to push science to think and think out of the box, and that is something which they do not appreciate. Now, when you go into the big wide world of science and you ask them, so what about Eric? They will say that they have convincingly shown that this man is either a fraud or talks complete nonsense. But actually, you know, the end analysis is pretty much that none of those things are true. And one clear example is the following. Eric drew, as one of the first people, the attention to a series of geoglyphs in Nazca in Peru. And he said that these, in his opinion, were to be seen from above, not from the earth, because from the earth you could hardly see anything. And really you had to be at a high altitude of, let's say, you know, 300 feet, if not higher, to begin to really appreciate what these geoglyphs looked like. And at the same time, he said that the layout looked as if it was like an airport. Now, mm-hmm. this was very much a descriptive analysis. So in 1968, when he drew the attention of the world to these geoglyphs, only one person, a woman called Maria Reiki, had done any kind of research into them, and pretty much her ambition was to preserve them because it was very close to the Pacific Highway, which stretches from the north to the south of the west coast of the Americas. And an awful lot of the big 10-ton trucks, if not more, really decided to veer off the highway and run across these deserts in that area, destroying some of the geoglyphs. And so her quest was all about making sure that they were preserved and, if possible, do some investigation into them. And she got nowhere. And then Eric arrived on the scene, and basically the eyes of the world were turned towards the Nazca Plateau, and scientists realized that they had to do something. Now, to cut a long story short, 40 years later, what we have is that people say, well, von Däniken has been disproven because this clearly wasn't an airport. Well, he never said it was. He said that it looked like an airport. But where we look at today is the fact that scientists have identified that these geoglyphs are part of a large civilization which had things like pyramids, which mummified their dead. But specifically, within this body of information are also some people who are now saying that these geoglyphs were indeed seen from above because the civilization had hot air balloons. And so Eric's premise is always that our ancestors, you know, whenever he makes a comment or a charge against science and specifically history and says that history is wrong, what he always says is that the historians have got it wrong and they need to do further research, and that he will specifically focus his attention on those areas where either our ancestors were more technologically advanced than we give them credit for, or where there might have been some outside factor which basically allowed that civilization to, you know, have a lasting legacy so that we think of it as extraordinary. And well, in the case of Nazca, what he has shown is basically this, that, you know, our ancestors are indeed more technologically advanced. And that is precisely what he set out to do in 1968. So rather than having been disproven, actually, you know, they have agreed with what Eric's conclusion was all along.
All right, so let me that was kind of quick, so forgive me if you've answered this already, but with the Nazca lines, you know, these images that you can only see from above, you know, from an airplane or something, how did the scientists dispute you know, his characterization that these images were probably for people who were looking at them from the sky? I mean, did they just think that was an assumption? But I mean, how could you even have created these you know, these drawings if you were on the ground, because it seems to me it would be very difficult for primitive people to create these huge drawings when you don't have the perspective of an aerial view.
Well, definitely the perspective of an aerial view was what they were aiming for. Now, whether they had that first on or whether this happened later, you know, at this moment in time, we don't know. Clearly, there was planning involved, and, you know, I think pretty much it's probably not that difficult to draw them because you know what you're doing. You can lay it out, you can use men, and kind of like, you know, point out what the general shape is going to be, and get it right. Once you have done it, though, that pretty much is it. Why have you done it? And there it really is that it's supposed to be seen from above. Now, the scientists basically say this. They just claim that Eric claims that this was a spaceport for extraterrestrial beings, which, again, is not something which he said. He said that it looked like an airport, and never did he add the thing that it was for ET, because he had actually been there before most of these scientists had gone there. And you can just see that these geoglyphs are very much basically scrubbing off the top soil on a few millimeters, sometimes a few inches below the top soil. It's this white, chalky surface, which is exposed, and because of the weather conditions in that area, which is very desert, hardly any rainfall at all in a year, a few drops of rain each year. These geoglyphs, for hundreds of years, were retained because it is so arid, it is so dry.
Right.
Now, basically, you know, all of these things, what happens everywhere, not just with Eric, is that people are pushed aside by the opponents, giving crackpot status to the person making it, and then skewing your research into such a way that it appears as if, you know, what that person saying is indeed crackpot. That
foolish,
has happened
yeah.
to Eric. That has happened to so many other people, and Eric is definitely not the sole person or the first
right.
person.
Right. No, of course not. Well, what's new in his in this new book that you've edited, Odyssey of the Gods? What's new in Odyssey of the Gods that you know, that he can continue to, you know, bring us new data? You know, what's going on in Greece that I guess substantiates his view that, you know, we really were visited?
The fact that we have this, as I said, we have this idea that the Greek civilization is very much like us, that they are the cradle of civilization, they had democracy, they had this, they had that. But really, that is not the case. And we think that we know the story of the Iliad. We have seen the movies, you know, War of the Titans, with the one about immortals is out right now. We think we know so much about ancient Greece. But the fact of the matter is that we don't. And a very simplistic example, but which illustrates it quite well, I think, is that when Eric goes and looks at the story of Jason and the Argonauts, what we have is this guy who seems to be very much, you know, it almost seems to be the script of The Hangover Part 3. It seems to be a bunch of lads led by Jason who are going to jump in a ship, go to a distant shore in Colchis, and are going to steal something, which is called the Golden Fleece. And when he starts looking at the modern translations, the Golden Fleece seems to be nothing more than a bit of fur. And so Eric's conclusion is like, hold on, why would everybody think this is so special, and why are we even talking about this? And so what he began to do was he began to strip away specifically the last 200 years of what people think of as translating, which is really editing. Because what was happening was that these people who were confronted with these stories felt that there were somehow inconsistencies with what the ancient Greeks were saying, and they didn't really seem to think or understand what they were doing. And so rather than just translate a word for word as to what the ancient Greeks were doing, they began to interpret and to you know, a large extent edit. And so Eric strips away this layer of editing and goes back to sometimes the original Greek versions to actually find out what the Greeks were saying. And at that moment in time, what you're beginning to realize is that the story of Jason and the Argonauts is completely different from what we think it is. It is the story about Jason, who realizes that there is something extraordinary hidden in Colchis, which is known as the Golden Fleece. And he assembles a group of men to go in search of this. And amongst these group of men are people who think that they can help Jason. Specifically, Jason is convinced that what this object is something which can fly, some kind of what we would call technology of either a distant lost era or an extraterrestrial, you know, origin. And amongst the people he takes with him, i.e. the Argonauts, there are people who say that if he is able to get this, then basically they think that they are able to pilot and or navigate this. At the same time, people are familiar with the story that what is happening is that this Golden Fleece is protected by what we would think of as dragons or other otherworldly creatures who spew fire and all of that stuff. But really, once you start looking again at all of the material, what you have are detailed accounts of pretty much a security system, even almost with an on and off switch, but definitely with a regularity. And again, as part of the Argonaut group of people, you have people who believe that they are able to both evade the system, but also to disable it. And so what you have is a very different kind of perspective once you peel off the layers of editing which has been happening in the last few centuries. And the original story is far more interesting, I think. And so rather than something what we consider to be ancient science fiction or ancient fiction, what we really have are accounts, and this is just one of them. The other ones are definitely examples of this as well. We have accounts of people who went to these distant shores because they felt that there were things hidden there, which they wanted to lay their hands on, and once they did, this would give them certain advantages, specifically in leading their people, if not developing certain bits for their society.
Well, you're not the first scholar or author to come on the show that has said, we are really under misconceptions because so many of the scholars can't read their own Greek, or in some cases, you know, some of my past guests have said, for instance, in the field of religion, Christians have done a lot of the translations, and so we end up getting a sort of a Christian interpretation or a Christian slant on things. And I mean, I know myself, you know, from researching my own book on sacred places, it was really difficult to get mythology of the ancient Hawaiians because ethnographers of the 18th century had sort of done their own editing or interpretation of the Hawaiian myths. So it was very difficult to get to the real story because it was filtered already through the person who was doing the translation. And I guess and that's what you're saying here as well.
Yes, absolutely. And also, you know, I mean, I always find it laughable, specifically what's happening in these days about the 2012 phenomena. They kind of go, oh, well, there's nothing, you know, very substantial about archaeology-wise about 2012. We really have very few indigenous writings when it comes to 2012. Now, first of all, the scholars will kind of like say, oh, you know, there's nothing. Well, that's not true. It's very little. But in so many cases, Christianity, and you know, not just Christianity, but other people as well, Nazi Germany, ancient Chinese rulers, they quite often burned books. So the very first thing the Spanish conquistadores did when they arrived in the Mayan Empire or when they arrived in Southern America was basically say, all that material over there, let's burn it because it's all of the devil. And 400 years later, what we have are scientists who say, well, you know, these people really had very few sources. They didn't like. It's like, no, they had tremendous amounts of writings. It's just that our ancestors decided to burn it all,
right.
And that is not the problem of this civilization. This is not the problem of the Mayan. But there is very much, I always think, an elitist attitude that we are better than, you know, whatever we conquered, and that we are better than our ancestors. And this is something which I think is a problem of our world, a problem of humanity, a problem of our time specifically, specifically a Western problem. It is something which really, I think, has to go on the way out, because when you are beginning to delve deeper into native traditions, you're beginning to find out that far more is preserved when you're beginning to look into ancient civilizations, you're beginning to realize that we really have a very blinkered view as to what was the truth about our ancestors.
Well, I wanted. I know in your book you get more into the, the idea of, you talk about the Chinese Roswell. You talk about, that there's actually stuff out there that can give us some explanations for 2012. And I want to get to that very soon here. But let's just finish on Odyssey of the Gods. What were some of the other pieces of Greek mythology that have been misinterpreted? I think maybe something about the story of Troy, was that one that we've gotten wrong, or maybe Atlantis?
Well, in both of those cases, Troy and Atlantis for a very long period of time were seen as mythical places. Everybody said that Troy didn't exist. And then Schliemann put spade to mouth and basically began to dig and said, here it is. And so all of a sudden, what people had said had never existed, all of a sudden had become a fact. It had made that jump from fiction to fact. And that is something which, pretty much Atlantis should be as well. What Eric is saying is, could we for a brief period of time stop questioning or hypothesizing, as to where Atlantis is, and let us address the question of Atlantis. And when we address it, to cut a long story short, Plato wrote about Atlantis in a book about history. He said that this was historical. He had detractors, skeptics of his own time who went to ancient Egypt, came back and said, he's right. The story of Atlantis is indeed known to the ancient Egyptians. Plato hasn't invented this. Now, what we have today are scholars who are saying, Plato invented this story about Atlantis. It's an idealized society. It never really existed. He invented it because he wanted to show certain moral issues and bring them to the forefront of Greek civilization. All of that is big nonsense. It is absolutely, completely void of anything which Plato was truly saying. But we are quite often letting scientists get away with this. And scientists love the fact that, they can just brush all of these things under a rug, or can make sweeping statements about them because they don't want to go into these things. And today when we look at Henrik Schliemann and Troy, it's almost as if they have forgotten that at one point, that the professors of academics and universities were really gung-ho and saying that Schliemann was an idiot and that there was nothing to Troy. But now, so many years later, what we really have and see is the fact that Troy definitely is real and is, a physical entity. And all of a sudden, the controversy around it seems to have been forgotten.
Well, I get that. But besides the Jason and the Argonaut account, can you recall another such myth that we're familiar with that we have wrong because it's been edited, which has led to our misunderstanding?
Yeah, I mean, Eric, gives several examples. Probably the most clear one is Zeus, the god, supreme deity of the ancient Greeks, and basically what he is saying is very much that our understanding is that the ancient Greeks had nothing to do with understanding the powers of nature, and so they thought that thunder and lightning was somehow controlled by this creature. Well, when you go into the accounts, you see that Zeus really is a creature who has extraordinary weaponry, and our ancestors described this weaponry as if it was like thunder and lightning. Once again, the like has been forgotten. It is almost as if we are looking at the atomic bomb explosions and we forget that we describe them as like giant mushrooms. At no point in time did our father's generation say that these atomic bombs were giant mushrooms which were exploding, and neither was this the case with the gods. And so pretty much everything about our ancestors, we really need to start looking with new eyes, and the ancient Greeks are just one example of so many civilizations where we need to start taking away this cloak of ancient science fiction away and start looking at it with new eyes. And then what we're beginning to realize is that what we are seeing are real stories of real people, and you know, something which is, I think, far more interesting than what we think of as allegorical accounts or moral stories for our ancestors, which is quite often the preferred solution which our scientists of today are giving to all of these stories.
So what does what would Eric's interpretation of Zeus be then? You know, if we're going to throw out you know, the edited version.
Pretty much that Zeus was a creature who was somehow physically present on this planet, that he had weapons at his disposal which he was willing to use, which he specifically used against people who were like him or of him, and that if, you know, he got upset with them, that he was not afraid of showing his weaponry. It's very similar to some of the stories which you hear from the Indian accounts, the Mahabharata, of deities, otherworldly creatures, you know, fighting amongst themselves.
So does Eric believe that most of the, you know, most of the pagan gods or whatever, or not just pagan gods, any of the gods, I guess, for that matter, does he believe that most of them were extraterrestrial beings that, or, you know, I mean, honestly, I haven't read Chariot of the Gods, I'll be honest with you. I mean, what I know I pick up from the History Channel, and one of my favorite series is Ancient Aliens. So, you know, what would Eric's interpretation of you know, all the Greek gods be? I mean, does he think they're all extraterrestrials or just some of them?
No, as a whole, the Greek gods, he would definitely qualify as a bunch of people who come from somewhere else, and, you know, were present on this planet at in a far long of forgotten time, but somehow witnessed by our ancestors. And, you know, our ancestors are the ones who are describing what they saw around them. Now, that is when it comes to, you know, ancient Greece. And Eric is also convinced that the same scenario was happening in other civilizations. Of course, he's not saying that every single deity across every civilization in the world was an extraterrestrial. But basically, when there is clear indication that our ancestors had a technology at their disposal, or where their mythology speaks about the fact that there were physical creatures present living amongst them, that is when Eric basically says we should trust our ancestors as to what they were saying, take them for their word, rather than side with science, who basically says that our ancestors were all stupid and didn't know what they were talking about.
So does he have an opinion about the Old Testament God or Jesus, for instance? I mean, where does he come down on them?
In Jesus, you know, Jesus was a man. I would say that his opinion on Jesus is not very much that he is indeed the Christ, but definitely not, he's not going to go as far as say that Jesus was an extraterrestrial. When it comes to you know, the God of the Bible, specifically the Jewish Bible, he will very much tell you that there are stories in there which clearly speak about a belief of the Jewish people in a supreme deity, which, you know, was the creator of the universe. But he will also highlight that there are stories in the Bible, as I do in my book, specifically the story of Ezekiel and Jonah, which clearly show that something else was going on, that there was, you know, a more physical presence here on planet Earth of weird things happening to human beings who are taken by the gods into spaceships to different regions of the Earth and are then being returned. Or in the case of Genesis 6, where we have the story of the Watchers, which clearly makes it apparent that there were a group of people, otherworldly creatures, who were mating with the females of our species in you know, some distant time, and that the creatures which were born, the babies which were born, were of such stature that quite a few of the women died in childbirth trying to give birth to these creatures because of the big heads which didn't fit through the pelvis of the mothers.
All right. So the final question for Eric's new book, which you edited, Odyssey of the Gods, and then we'll jump over to your book. If the gods are real and if they are extraterrestrial beings, what do you believe that means for mankind? And what effect do you think it would have on our modern civilization, I guess, if that were suddenly to become widely accepted?
Well, it will, I think, give us once again a sense of exploration. When we look at society these days, it really lacks in thrust, it lacks in vision. Remember only half a century ago when we either wanted to survive a Cold World War, which was a very basic need, but definitely it made us excel in so many things. It brought great innovation about. Then we had, of course, the rush to the moon. And in more recent decades, it just seems that the only thing we want to do is play in front of the television and or play computer games. And there is no real big trust for mankind, no real vision. And I think this has an effect on the economy. When you see where we are as a global society, you're seeing that there are an awful lot of problems and an awful lot of dissent and basically dispersion of people, because we should really be uniting around a common vision for mankind. And I think this is something which is going to happen. And I think, ancient aliens or Eric's writings are definitely not the primary instigator of this, but they are definitely part of the solution and part of the symptom, whereby we see that there is this drive for mankind to really once again begin to tackle some of the larger questions in life and try to come up with answers.
Well, in all of this work that people like you and Eric, and I know there are other scholars that, believe this too, is there a general consensus? Or has anyone found anything that might hint at, we will see these ETs in some sort of a transparent and obvious way in the future? I mean, if they came once before, why do we not see them anymore? Why have they stopped visiting, I guess? If they've, unless you believe that maybe they are still visiting. I mean, you hear about people with abduction stories and stuff like that. But are we talking about the same sorts of ETs even when we talk about abduction stories versus the kind of stuff, that you and Eric are talking about?
Well, the short answer is we don't know. And the reason why we don't know is that, there's very few and discarded people looking at this. We are confronted with a gigantic enigma where millions of scientists are basically saying we're not interested in looking into this. So when it comes to the various sections as to, were we alone, obviously the people who are appearing on Ancient Aliens are all convinced that we were indeed not alone in the past. As to the nature of those creatures, that depends, because some of those people the experts have different areas of expertise. And when it comes to things like the UFO phenomenon or various other things, the answer is we simply don't know. Now, we went to the moon in the 1960s, early 1970s. We never went back there. So this notion that somehow we were contacted in the past doesn't necessarily imply that we are still being contacted or that we are going to be contacted in the future. And the people who contacted us in the past are not necessarily the people who might be contacting us today as part of the UFO phenomenon. So the only thing we really know for sure is that in this world, there are far stranger things going on than what science and most people are willing to accept. But I think that it's also time that we really, get together and as a species, not just as a bunch of researchers who appear on television, but as a species come together and say that we really need to start looking into these big answers and that we put a challenge up to science to say that they need to help us and really start to try and find some of these answers to the question whether we are alone or not, what is out there in the universe and kind of like what is a more expanding view of history rather than the very narrow stream or interpretation of history, which all too many scientists are adhering to at this moment in time.
Well, it's easy, isn't it? I mean, I guess even if some of them might want to entertain the idea, they would be too afraid to be ridiculed if they talked about it publicly. But aren't more and more people in the military, actually come in, especially in other countries? It seems like they are actually they seem to be coming out in larger numbers. You know, credible people, you know, talking about encounters and things like that. Am I correct about that?
Yes, there are definitely more people talking about it. And actually, specifically, an awful lot of American people, military servicemen people within the CIA are talking about this right now. The way they are talking about it makes it very hard to really do anything more with it than just, you know, recording the fact that several dozens, if not hundreds of people are talking about these things. Some of the things they say do gel with each other's testimony. Sometimes there are contradictions. Sometimes it is clear that there is a level of fact in there, but also a level of speculation in the sense that, you know, when you are working in a compartmentalized environment, you don't really know what goes beyond this. And some of the people who interview these scientists or military people or whatever, quite often want to push towards final answers as to, okay, what do you think you saw? And then these people obviously will give an interpretation as to what do they think they saw. To some extent, I quite often think that this isn't the best approach to do if people were to just say, this is my experience and this is what I know for sure. And if we were to collect this as a body of evidence, it would be more powerful than just have a body, of various people and their, and a mixture of what is evidence and a mixture of what is their opinion as to what is going on. But pretty much that is something which is far more, to me at least, the bailiwick of UFO people rather than what is happening as part of the ancient alien phenomenon.
All right, well, let me give the title of your book again, the full title, because I didn't give the subtitle before. It's The Ancient Alien Question, A New Inquiry into the Existence, Evidence, and Influence of Ancient Visitors. So, Philip, what do you see as the best evidence that we have been visited by extraterrestrials?
Basically, the total amount of it. There are obviously, you know, individual accounts, like, as you mentioned, the Chinese Roswell, the story of Awanis in Babylonia. But as a whole, the fact that there are archaeological remains which defy a common explanation. And then when you look at the historical evidence, you're confronted with stories of the local people who basically say that this was something which was done by the gods. And you find this in various civilizations. You find this in Mexico or the Mayan heartlands. You find this in South America. And to some extent, you also find it in places like Egypt and, in lesser extent, the megalithic civilization like Stonehenge and Avebury. When it comes to such things as India, what you have are accounts like in the Mahabharata or the Bhagavad Gita of accounts which say that in the past, in those skies, extraordinary things were seen, a battle of the gods with weapons, which very much look today like modern warfare, if not radioactive machinery. And it is then of interest, I think, that when you look at societies like Mohenjo-Daro or Harappa in Pakistan, what you see are people lying in the streets which were clearly struck by something which killed them instantaneously. Now, whether that is something which, you know, is described in the Mahabharata is another question, but it is definitely an interesting question to pose. And also the fact that in India, there have been patches found of radioactivity, which so far has defied really a clear explanation. Now, to really make that all of them fit into what I would describe as rather best evidence, but proof, really what is needed is the active participation of scientists. And that is something which is unfortunately sorely lacking when it comes to some of these things, including in the Chinese Roswell, where really we are confronted with a tribe who might have actually descended from people who were not of this planet. And so when you look at photographs of them from the 1940s, you really see that these creatures are, or these beings are quite inhuman in their appearance. They have a thick skull, a round skull, deep-set eyes, what I would describe as quite dwarfish in appearance, size-wise. But, you know, to go beyond that, what you really need are experts in geneticists, people who are really willing to take DNA samples and start to do detailed research with this.
I see what you mean.
And really what you have is a bunch of scientists who say that they know that ET never was here, so why should they ever bother with all of these experiments when they know that they are going to be negative? And that is an attitude which really, I think, needs to change, not just on the ancient alien question, but on so many things the big questions, the big why questions, which mankind is facing and which science isn't willing to answer.
We can't even get people to agree that climate change is real. So, you were talking about these, the genetic work that needs to be done, and you quickly sort of glossed over. I think you said some beings in China. Does that have to do with the Chinese Roswell? Because I've never heard about this. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. It is about the Chinese Roswell. And the Chinese Roswell is basically about the fact that, we have a story which was originating in 1962 of a group of people who claimed to have deciphered disks which had been positioned next to bodies in a cave in the Bayankara Ula mountain range, which is pretty much in a remote part of China towards Tibet. And in 1962, the decipherment of these inscriptions on the disks basically said that the people who were buried there had been descendants of a group of people who had come to planet Earth on a crashed spacecraft several thousand years ago. And when they realized that they couldn't return, that they decided to stay here and, began to interbreed with the locals. And very much up until the 1940s, people made contact with these tribes, and the tribe basically said that, yes, they descended from them. In 1997, the tribe has been relocated, has been re-identified, and what has been found is that they indeed look very strange. And now there is a hope that there is going to be some more scientific investigation, as I said, that DNA is going to be investigated and that hopefully certain conclusions can be drawn. But for that, again, we need to have the active participation of science.
So do we have any of these people still living today, or we would just be checking the DNA from their bones?
No, these people are very much alive. At least they were a decade ago, so I would think that they are still alive today. The royal line, what I would call the most ancient and pure line of DNA available, has come to a stop in somewhere in the 1940s, 1950s. But that doesn't mean that the people who are living there today, they definitely have enough genetic material to do the analysis as to whether or not they have extraterrestrial components in there or not.
Are there pictures of these people on the internet or in your book, The Ancient
there
Alien
are
Quest?
Indeed, yes, there are indeed photographs of these creatures in my book. Even though it's a black and white photograph, obviously because of its time, it is a very clear photograph which clearly shows that these beings are very alien looking.
And so a decade ago, how many of them did we have left? A handful, a few dozen, or what?
It really depends as to how you are going to define a family, I would say. But definitely they were confronted with a few hundreds of them. This was in a remote part of China. It is very hard to say how many there are today, specifically because China is very much evolving country when it comes to its people. But definitely there are sufficient amount of people alive today who claim to be descendants and are categorized as being part of this dropper tribe.
Okay. All right, let's shift gears a little bit because we have about 20 minutes left and I want to hit on a couple different points. And let me go to this one first because I think this, everybody is so, on pins and needles about 2012. Your research has uncovered an extraterrestrial connection in the form of archaeological evidence to the 2012 phenomenon. What is that connection and how are you defining the 2012 phenomena?
Well, basically what we have is the fact that the 2012 date is known. it's inscribed in Mayan inscriptions, and specifically the inscription in a Mayan complex called Tortuguero says that what is going to happen on December 21st, 2012 is the return of the nine gods. Now, clearly the question is, how is that defined? Is this an extraterrestrial being? Is this a more metaphysical entity? What is this? And for that, we need to go into the anthropological record, because there what we are confronted with are accounts of how these deities came to the Mayan heartland every 400 years, and together with the leaders of the Mayans, basically ended world ages and declared the fate of a new world for the next 400 years, or in this case also for the next 5,000 years, because basically what the 2012 phenomenon is about is basically the marking and the end of a calendar. And very much the Mayans didn't believe that the world was going to end, but they believed that there was a cyclical pattern to time, that time and again we were working together with non-human intelligences in setting out certain challenges which we as mankind felt had to aim for. It's very much like a project plan. In the next 500 years, we're going to try and do this. And very much what they thought was the plan for the last 5,000 years was that mankind should grow spiritually. And this is definitely, I think, despite what people think today, something which actually does or has happened. The turmoil we are in economically, politically, different for each continent, but definitely turmoil. The old values are being questioned, and we are actually asked to come up with new values and new definitions, specifically political entities. Politicians are trying to cling to borders, which in truth no longer exist, yet we are trying to defend them. Why? All of these questions really need to be taken out and brought out and discussed, and this is, I don't think it's a coincidence that this is happening specifically at this moment in time, and it is conforming to what the Mayans, have always said and are saying today, which is that we live in times of change.
So then you would say that as all this turmoil is rising around the globe, as we're fighting for justice, fighting for transparency, fighting to rid ourselves of, capitalist oppression or predator capitalism, this whole thing that, that everybody's railing against, this is part of what the Mayans predicted, this new phase that we'll enter into that will lead us to be a more spiritual humankind. I mean, that's sort of the seeds that we're planting now.
Well, I don't think it's I don't think it's going to happen by default. It is the only way for mankind to go. We live in a global village, full stop. And the powers that are, specifically politicians, are trying to cling on to that. When you look at Europe, for example, what you have is a market economy which is European in nature, yet politicians which are national, who are still trying to come up with things like border control. You see the same thing happening in Northern America. To some extent imported from European politics, these cry of defending our borders and all of that stuff. And it really is politicians talking absolute nonsense. It doesn't conform to reality, and it is not really something which is beneficial or helpful. Borders are being dropped left, right, and center. In Central America, these borders are being dropped on a very pragmatic level. All of these things are happening across the world. And the Occupy movement is, in places, 2,000 places across the world. It is not just something whereby they are fed up with the politics of Jerry Brown in California or the mayor of New York or Obama in America. No, it is a global problem because we live in a global economy. We have global problems. If tomorrow, a bank like Chase or Barclays or BNP in France fails, guess what? The entire economy of the world is going to collapse. And that is just a reality. And for politicians to continue to address us as if we are quite often idiots, or that they feel that they have to address us on a very local basis on certain issues, specifically some of the things which Obama is doing and saying, are really politicians who have lost touch with reality, who are preaching to a very minority of the people who they think, you know, really care about these things. But they are bypassing the far bigger problems, which they really should be addressing. And once they were to address those big problems, I think, first of all, their political careers would be far safer. And also, you know, the world would be a better place rather than just the quite empty-handed rhetorics they're going through right now.
Well, you know, we're moving into a new paradigm, and they're trying to apply old paradigm solutions. You mentioned that in December 2012, did you say something about the six or the nine gods return or something like that? Is that metaphorically? Is that an astrological alignment? What is that?
Well, it's definitely not, as far as we can tell. You know, from a mind perspective, these were real non-human intelligences. So something which definitely happened. So it's not something which you can just say, oh, it's a constellation which is or an astrological component or anything like that. That might also be the case, but it is definitely far more real, far more tangible. What the Mayans were really saying was that there were these creatures, these non-human intelligences. And it's not just the Mayans who are saying this. The Mayans were also extraordinarily important for the ancient Egyptians. People in modern times have also tried to make contact with these intelligences. So it's definitely quite a big team.
So, and I think you said that these come around every 400 years or so. Did I catch that part right? Do we have any indication 400 years ago that they came and appeared? I mean, was there any evidence of that the previous visit?
The Mayans at that moment in time made contact with the Spanish conquistadors' headquarters in Merida in the Yucatan, and to basically tell them that they were gathering in Chichen Itza and that they were holding rituals and ceremonies because for them it was a back-to-ending ceremony, and these deities were going to appear. So yes, we do have accounts of that, and we also have accounts of the Mayans saying that this happened, you know, at the previous intervals, roughly 1100, you know, AD, working your way back with 600, 100, and so on, all the way back to 3112 BC.
Interesting. So I mean, it can actually be documented back in time that these intelligences have actually appeared on the planet. Am I getting that right?
What is absolutely documented and accepted by anthropologists is that these ceremonies were held, and that the Mayans were absolutely convinced that something materialized and made contact with them. Now, again, scientists will say that the Mayans were hallucinating and that this is something which is idiotic because they know that these entities don't exist. But that, again, is a scientific spiel on what the Mayans are saying was absolutely factual. So it is, you know, up to the individual observer to either take the Mayans at their word or to disagree with what they report. But the fact of the matter remains that the Mayans reported that at these clear intervals in time, non-human intelligence has contacted their leaders, and that the fate of the next period of time, i.e. normally 400 years, was defined as to what the mind should aim for as a species.
Okay. All right. So this might be the last question we have time for, but proponents of the ancient alien theory claim the gods are aliens and that there's really no God. Do you believe that's true, or what's your opinion on that particular subject?
Well, I definitely believe that there is a God. And I also actually believe that the gods with the small g, who quite often were ET, actually came here to tell us about gods with a big G. I think what happened was that people, when they were confronted with the Bible, and specifically Christianity when they were confronted with the Bible, began to make an entire mess of it. They began to, you know, try to shoehorn everything. And so what you have are various accounts which somehow all had to be evidence of God with a big G, and they shoehorned this into their story. And I think this is where it went wrong. And I think when people began to realize that this was an error, some people began to doubt the fact that, you know, the gods with the small G had to be the same as gods with a big G. I'm not one of those people. I think it is an end universe. There is room for gods with a small G, and there is definitely room for gods with a big G.
Well, Philip, in our remaining 2 or 3 minutes here, I know there's not much left, and there's so much more we could talk about, and we're just sort of out of time. What do you think are the most important points for listeners to grasp, about this subject?
Basically, that we are confronted with an extraordinary question, which is whether or not we are alone and whether or not there is evidence that we were not alone. And the answer is that all our ancestors said that we were not alone. To a large extent, you know, that we didn't walk the path of civilization alone. And what I try to show in the book is basically the evidence that we are indeed not alone, that society, civilization was guided and helped by these non-human intelligences. And I hope that this also begins to reveal to the people who read the book that, you know, history is completely different, and that this idea that science is there to uncover great truths might have been real at some point, but definitely in recent time, and specifically when it applies to archaeology and history, that this is not the case. That there is a paradigm struggling to survive, which is that we are the symptom of creation, and that we are, you know, it, and that we have done all of this by ourselves, and that is simply not conformed to what our ancestors were saying. Our ancestors were saying that the gods once lived amongst them, and that the gods were in contact with them, and that the gods helped them. And this is a message, I think, which is, trying to get out again. And I hope that my book contributes to the debate and also points out the reader in those directions as to where the evidence lies.
So how can we get your book, Philip? And again, the title, The Ancient Alien Question.
Well, basically, The Ancient Alien Question, just like Odyssey of the Gods, is available everywhere where books are sold. This means Amazon and Barnes & Noble online. Any bookshop, specifically in Northern America, Barnes & Noble, have them. And Barnes & Noble is actually doing a special promo in the lead-up to Christmas from the 12th to 13th of December to the 26th of December, when it will be prominently displayed. But basically, every Barnes & Noble or any normal bookshop in America currently has copies of this book available. And again, if you can't find a bookshop near you, online it is available as well.
And do you have a website, Philip?
I do. My website is philipcoppens.com. That is PhilipCoppens. If you type that name into Facebook or Twitter, you will also be directed to me. And from my website, you can also click on the Twitter and Facebook feeds there.
Okay. Well, Philip, thank you so much for your time tonight. It's been intriguing. I love the subject. I love to think outside of the box. I'm not one of these people who, has to live by, the narrow confines of traditional history. And I think this is just an intriguing subject. And I agree with you. I think there's too much out there for us to be closed-minded to this idea. I really do. In fact, one of the mottos of my show, because, we feel like the sacred feminine has been swept under the rug by religion, by patriarchy. One of the mottos of the show is from the German philosopher, author Schopenhauer, all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. And, maybe one day you and Eric and folks like you will be validated, and we won't be asking these questions anymore. We'll finally have the answers.
Absolutely, and that is definitely my hope. And specifically, it's not so much about Eric and me, but definitely that we are beginning to treat our ancestors with the respect that they are due, and that we take them at their word rather than to try and put their material out in a way that we think is the truth rather than what we should know is the truth, which is what they were saying all along.
Well, yeah, it's not about any one person. It's about humankind knowing our origins, knowing our history. I mean, really, what's more important than that? You know, I think that that's an important question for humans to know and to have. Well, thank you, Philip. I hope you and yours have a wonderful holiday season. Good luck with the book, and thank you so much for being on the show. It's been great. I'm glad you gave us some of your time.
Thank you for having me, and also happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody else.
Okay. Good night. Well, listeners, that's about it for tonight. I hope you've enjoyed our show about alternative history. In a way, when you think about it, it really does fit in with the sacred feminine because to many, for a long time, the sacred feminine was alternative history. And please remember to come back again next Wednesday. We will have the Reverend Billy from the documentary What Would Jesus Buy? He's going to be our guest at the top of the hour, followed by Gina Messina Dyson. Coming on the second half of the show, talking about the Feminism and Religion Project. So, happy Thanksgiving. Please remember to be thankful. Don't be duped by the stories out there, the sanitized version of Thanksgiving. Make sure you really know the story of Thanksgiving, and you can get it on my Facebook page if you like. So, good night, listeners, and again, I will be with you next Wednesday. Thank you for tuning in.